All right, you're all going to be down here in this recording for posterity. Very exciting. What we're going to do today is very much a series of psukim, famous story. I want to leave behind the Avimelech story. Chapter 10, Perek Yud, which I mentioned last time, is really not going to take up our time, mainly because it doesn't really contain a lot of information. There are a number of shoftim who are mentioned, who are there, but not really, as they say, doing very much, apart from having sort of large families. They don't seem to be doing very much at all. I suppose you can say that is doing something, but not necessarily fighting the wars of Israel. So what happens by the end of chapter 10, which is where we will start today, the end of Perek Yud, is the new enemy. Okay, remember, we've had the Canaanim, we've had the Midianim, we've had, I've forgotten all the different names, Sisera and all these various characters. We're working our way around the country of all the different enemies of Israel. Yeah.
So just before we go on, in the beginning of chapter 10, it goes through a few different shoftim. If it doesn't say in the middle, like, that they, Israel, continue to do what this place God, does that mean that they, like, continued on the up and up for, like,
correct,
time?
Correct. There's no moving away from tradition during that time, right? The reality is, and you're raising a good point, most of the 360, whatever years it was, 369, of the shoftim, really, everything was the way it should be. All right. The only time that we see there's a problem is when they break away from tradition, and then you see they're under captivity for 18 years or for 8 years. And if you think about it, out of 360, if you're talking about maybe 50 or 60 years when they're not doing what they're supposed to do, it does tell you that during the majority of that time period, things were really the way they should be. Right? You had judges at the beginning of Perek Yud who were judges for 20 years, 30 years, and everything was quiet. Okay, so that in itself was a point. Rabbi Miller makes that point, and Victor Miller is one of the passed away a number of years ago, who was somebody who wrote about Tanakh in the very early days, meaning 50 or 60 years ago. He started bringing out books on those types of topics. He was a teacher in Brooklyn in various yeshivot, and he makes this point that as bad as it seems, the overall observance level was very high during the period of Shoftim. The problem was that when they went bad, they went very bad. All right, it really went from one extreme to the other, and that was the big issue. And that's something that we always have to be kind of aware of. And when it does go extreme, when it goes bad, it goes to the other extreme. Okay, but at the same time, when it goes to the other extreme, it comes back again. And you'll get a judge like Yiftach, who we think is not such a great person, but he has tremendous qualities, tremendous positive qualities, right? The problem is, he's in a generation in which ignorance seems to be happening. And when the generation is ignorant, then mistakes take place, even at the highest level, as they can in any generation, right? And that's something we're going to deal with. So your point's a great point, so thank you for that. All right, let's have a look at Perek Yud Aleph. And we're going to sort of rattle our way through this chapter, ideally finishing it. And for next time, if we don't get through it today, you're going to have to just finish off Perek Yud Bet. Because Yud Aleph and Yud Bet really go together. This is the new judge called Yiftach. Jephthah in English, right? Yiftach is a character who, initially, we are told, comes from a very, not dysfunctional, but very low privilege or underprivileged background. Okay, and that's very important to understand, that the judges really reflected the generation in the sense that when you had really a strong group of knowledgeable people in the days of Othniel, they would have a judge like Othniel, who was someone who was close to Moshe Rabbeinu, who was a great tzaddik in so many ways. When the generation is further removed from those values, then the leadership reflects it. But of course, the leadership still is there to bring the generation up, not to bring the generation down. So I want that to be understood, that we're talking about very exceptional people, not maybe on the standards of what we've seen before, but within their own generation, they are still there to raise the level as high as they can, raising the bar as high as possible. So I want that to be understood before we go on. Even Yiftach, who seems to get a very indifferent press when it comes to people writing about him, reality is that he also was a link in the chain of passing on the oral Torah. He was someone who eventually, I mean, unfortunately, he seems to have learned it the hard way. He learned some of the halachot that he needed to know in the hardest way possible by his famous story with his daughter. That was in itself something which shows that there was a commitment, at least, to Jewish law. No question about that. Okay, I want that to be understood, that we're not dealing with someone who is really down and out, but we're dealing with someone who is on a lower level, reflecting the kind of generation into which he is born. Okay, so I think that's a point I wanted to make by way of introduction. So please follow. Perek Yud Alef, and we are going to try and get through this, ideally, the whole chapter. It's a long one, but it's famous. Yiftach today would be considered a very right-wing, politically charged individual. When it comes to the issues of the state of Israel, the land of Israel, okay, if he went to negotiate in the United Nations, there would not be, too many people left in the room by the time he's finished his speech. Most people would have walked out. But you know something? Sometimes you need a guy like that. You need someone to stand up and say it the way it really is. Okay, well, in this case, the way it really was. Listen to this, chapter 11. Ve'yiftach ha-giladi, ha-yah gibor chayil. His fame was that he was a gibor chayil, he was a strong guy. Okay, ve'hu ben'isha zona. He was born to a woman who was zona, was basically a harlot, prostitute. And the question is, was she really, or was she in fact married to this gentleman called, to the father, whose name was Gilad? She was married to him, or was she in fact zona, meaning they were not married? It's not clear. But the suggestion is that she is certainly not a fully fledged wife with children having rights equal to the other children in the family. It's very similar to what we've seen, that when one of the children is born, like Avimelech was, right, out of the normal line of the other children, then it becomes problematic and they push him out. And in this case, Yiftach suffered the same attitude from his half-brothers. So it says, Vayolid Gilad et Yiftach. Gilad was the father, and this woman, Isha Zona, was the mother, we don't know her name, and they had a child called Yiftach, and this guy, Gilad, already had other children, okay, presumably from a regular wife. That's the way to describe it. But Tele Deshet Gilad lo banim. Right tells you, the wife of Gilad had other children. Vayigdalu b'nei ha'isha v'yigarshu et Yiftach. This is something very not nice. What did they do? They grew up and they drove him away. Yiftach was considered to be an outsider, which is not acceptable. You're not going to be part of the inheritance. And this, of course, becomes very, very traumatic. Okay, that Yiftach is actually thrown out. He is thrown away from the family. He is kicked out. He's not going to inherit, according to the brothers, the way he should have done. The problem with this is that the whole society around knew about this, and nobody said a word, right? This is always a very big issue. Kol Yisrael Arevim Zeh B'Zeh. Jews are considered to be responsible for each other. And if something happens like this, and nobody stands up and says something, then it is a very bad indictment on the whole generation. So I want you to be aware of that. That's why protest is sometimes really important. Okay, sometimes, yeah. Yeah, the leaders generally, but in this case nobody says a word. Pinchas, who is still alive. Sorry, again?
So they're all getting penalized for it?
The whole generation is being criticized for it. Whether they'll be penalized, we'll have to wait and see. The answer is yeah, they're being penalized by a new enemy. But they're certainly being criticized, as you'll see in Yiftach's reaction to the leaders who want him to come back. Because they want a leader, they want someone to lead the army. Yiftach is the obvious guy, he's got a reputation of being someone who can do it, but he turns around and says, you drove me out. And of course, the other leaders didn't drive him out. It was his brothers who drove him out. But the fact was, they said nothing. Silence in this case is as if you are admitting, helping the, aiding and abetting the crime, as they say. Shtika kohoda. Listen to this. So what happened? Gimel. Vayivrach Yiftach ne'echav. So Yiftach to run away. Where did he go? Vayeshev Eretz Tov. He went to the land of Tov. And nobody quite knows if Tov is the name of the guy running this particular place, or whether it is Eretz Tov, meaning the land of, but by that name, it was a good place. It's outside Eretz Israel. So Yiftach left Israel. This is agreed by everybody. And he became a kind of magnet for people who were rekim. Rekim means literally empty. People who were kind of, how should we say? Again, back to the Robin Hood story. He had a band of merry men who joined him, who were also people rejected either by their families or by society. You know, that's the way it goes. Unfortunately, like to like in this case. Fascinating. And it was after some time, we're not told how long, and the Ammonites started fighting with the Jews. Ammonites coming from somewhere again, Jordan, maybe further north, Moab and Ammon were very close to each other. It's probably nowadays you would call it from the Jordanian side, from that direction. In other words, from east, from the east. What happened? They started, B'nai Ammon in Israel, they started fighting against Israel. So the elders of Gilad, which was the first territory into which the Ammonites would invade, they were very scared. This enemy is coming to take us over. So they needed a leader, someone to lead the army. So they ran to Yiftach in the land of Tov, wherever that is, and they was going to say to Yiftach, come home. Alright? Come home. But Yomru Yiftach, come. He haitalan lekatsin. He are officer. They need a general in the army. They're very specific. They're not looking for someone to be a religious leader. They're looking for someone to be a military leader. Alright, I want that to be clear. But Nilchama B'nai Ammon, we're going to fight B'nai Ammon. So, that's the plan, and it was a very honest request. Yiftach, as I guess most of you will realize, is very entitled to turn around and say, but I was rejected once. Why now should I turn around and come home? You don't want me. At least by not stopping my brothers doing what they did, you show that you don't want me. So look at Yiftach's reaction, Zion. But Yom Yiftach Zinei Gilad, he said, Alo atem senetim oti. You guys hate me. But to Gorshuni Beit Avi, I was driven out from my father's house. Umadua. Umadua is always a very strong word. In Hebrew, there are two words for why. Alright, the famous word which is Lama, right? Which is Lama, like you go to Israel. Every 2 seconds, someone will go up to you. If you ask them a question, Lama, right? That's what they'll say with the hand movement. But in the strongest possible terms, Madua, which you do hear in modern Hebrew. You hear the word Madua. Madua is why with a capital W. Why? For why, as maybe someone would say. Umadua batem elayata. Why? Capital W. Why do you come to me now? Kashet tsar lechem, when you're in trouble. Right? Tsar, tsarot, narrow. Tsar also means tsarot, trouble. You're in trouble. Why are you knocking on my door? You helped by not stopping my brothers throwing me out. You are aiding and abetting the crime. You helped them get rid of me. Now you want me back? No way. So look what they said to him. It's very interesting. They appealed to his sense of what we call in French esprit de corps, meaning, somebody help me out here, spirit of community. All right, that's how it's always translated. Some of the girls on the back here can help me out here, but they didn't hear what I said. How do you translate esprit de corps? How would you call that? Right? Esprit de corps. Spirit of the heart, literally. Corps is the heart, right? Esprit de corps, it's an expression. Spirit of the communal spirit. Feeling of achdut, unity. All right? You know what I'm talking about. That's probably my French pronunciation is useless. Whatever it is, esprit de corps. It's an expression that is used, borrowed from French. All right. Listen to this. So they appealed to his communal feeling. Look what they said to him. So they said to him, we've come back to you. You're telling us that we hate you, but we're here. Right? The fact is that we don't hate you because we've come back to you. We need you. B'nai Ammon are a very dangerous enemy. We need a leader. Right? And you'll be ahead to all the people in Gilad. In other words, they are kind of appealing to him, I suppose, to his sense of wanting to be a leader, or wanting to be certainly ahead of the army. And they are really begging him. And I suppose at this point in time, he can't turn around and say no. He would be very heartless to say that. Vayome Yiftach el Zignei Gilad. He said to them the following. And Yiftach again shows a tremendous amount of what the word is, I suppose you would say courage, I would say maybe a sense of responsibility. He's not such a reject as he was described in the beginning. Okay, and listen to what he says. 10. Bayoma Yiftach al Zignei Gilad. Im Meshivim Atem Oti Lelachem B'nei Amon. If you take me back to lead you in the war, V'natan Hashem Otam Lefanai, and God will help us to beat the enemy, basically. Anochi Eyeh Lechem L'Rosh. Then I will be your head. In other words, Yiftach says, don't take me sight unseen. I've got to prove myself. Okay, so this is a guy who's not as bad as it would seem. He is someone who clearly is trusting in God. He has the fear of Hashem. Yirei Shamayim, right? There's not. I'm trying to dispel some of the myths. Because a lot of people, when they talk about Yiftach, they all know the one phrase. Yiftach bedoro kishmuel bedoro. Or Shmuel bedoro kiyiftach bedoro, whichever way around it is. Right? That Shmuel in his generation was like Yiftach in his. Shmuel was very holy. His generation was very holy. Yiftach, not so holy because his generation was not so holy. And the suggestion always is very derogatory towards Yiftach. And I want to show you that Yiftach is not such a negative person. There's a lot to say about Yiftach on the positive side. Okay? There is a commentary, maybe next time I'll bring it if I remember, from Rav Soloveitchik's uncle. Rav Soloveitchik of Yeshiva University, his uncle, Rav Velvel, who was known as the Briskerov, originally from the town of Brisk in Poland, Lithuania, was a very major Rav and Rosh Hashiva in Eretz Yisrael. He died in 1958. And he wrote lots and lots of things, or was written down. He spoke about lots of things. They didn't actually write it down. A lot of people wrote it for him. And he gives this kind of approach to Yiftach. He says Yiftach should not be misunderstood as someone negative. He really wasn't as bad as he's made out sometimes to be. Okay, so that's a point that I'm trying to make at the beginning here. We're dealing with someone who, yes, reflects the generation which is weak, certainly as we see in the story of the vow, very weak, but not completely down and out. Okay, listen to this. Yud. Vayorizignei Gilad al Yiftach. So the people said to Yiftach, they said, Hashem yesh shomea beinotenu, God should be like a witness between us, im lo kidavarcha kenaseh, that if we do not do according to your words. In other words, we promise in the name of God to agree to your term. If you win the war, you will be Rosh. You will be the judge. You will lead the whole country. We are speaking on behalf of Am Yisrael. Wow. Look what goes on here. Yudal. Now Yiftach has got to energize the Jewish people to fight. And this is very difficult. Okay? They've got an enemy who is very oppressive. The Ammonites, the Moabites, all of them were very difficult to deal with because of certain traits, certain midot, right? Certain behaviors which were very hard to find. And listen to this, Yudal. Vayelech Yiftach im Zignei Gilad v'yasima am oto la'aleim l'rosh. L'katzin, so he goes with the elders and he becomes the leader. Vayedaber Yiftach et kol devarav l'fnei Hashem b'mitzvah. And now he goes to mitzvah and he starts to say all of his words before God. And of course, the idea is that he goes either to amongst Am Yisrael, B'toch Ha'am, where the Shekhinah would dwell. God will be within the congregation of Israel. Or we can say that maybe the mitzvah in a holy place. Look at Rashi, mitzvah, makom shenesu kulam, shashekhinah shora al rov ha'tzibur. Right? Not the Mishkan where normally God would be spoken to, or davened. You know, you would go and daven at the Mishkan. Here would be amongst the multitudes of the Jewish people. So he is going to rally the troops. He's a pretty brave guy, because they could turn around and reject him. Look what happens here, you bet. Vayishlach Yiftach malachim o'melech b'nei Amon le'mor. At this point, obviously the people accept his leadership. And now he's going to have an initial attempt to try and make peace, I suppose you can say, with b'nei Amon. And I want to just mention this because it's important. A lot of people think that, you know, the whole situation, peacemaking is a very difficult thing. We know in this generation it's proving incredibly difficult. Okay, especially as there's nobody really on the other side to talk to make peace with. And Yeshua already set the standard. Yeshua, before he conquered Eretz Israel, he sent letters, according to Midrash, he sent letters to all of the leaders of the communities in Israel, all the groups, and he said, we're coming, this is our ancient homeland, we want to make peace with you. Under certain conditions, we will not fight, we will not make war, but we will make peace. And they all rejected it. Every single one of them sent back a message to Yahushua, to put it very bluntly, get lost. Didn't want to know. Except a few individuals. Rachab was one of the individuals that some of you are writing about. The Givonim, another group of people that did accept Yahushua's letter, and they made peace. In this story over here, again, Yiftach knows that the tradition is before you make war, you make peace. You try and speak, you try and negotiate. Because if you haven't negotiated enough, then you haven't done your job, not to go to war as the first option. And this is something which I think is a very important lesson to learn from this story. Look what he does, Yud Gimel. But so he sends a message to the Ammonites, why are you coming to fight? What are you doing here? Alright? In other words, if there's no reason for you to be here, please leave. So what do they say to him? They sent a message back from the king of Ammon. And what did they say? Kilakach Yisrael et arzi balotom mimisraim. Wow. And this is so interesting, a parallel to today. They said that you Jews do not have been living here fairly. You took the land when you came out of Egypt. You conquered this land and you took it, you never returned it. Now again, the argument is that land which was taken by force should not therefore belong to you. And of course, if you're listening carefully, you hear the parallel to today's political situation. It really is quite amazing. All right, that again, the same argument. Why are you in Israel? It's Palestine, right? Till 1948, the Palestinians didn't exist. The Palestinians who were around in 1948 were actually Jewish. Because in 1948, people living in Israel, when it was called Palestine by the British, were Palestinians. Okay, 600,000 Jews who were living there. So the whole argument today of creating a country called Palestine is a very difficult argument. Very difficult, but the world has sort of swallowed it and uses it constantly. The story then is very interesting, that Yiftach is being told by the enemy, we want the whole land that you took, we want it back. Alright, now Yiftach turns around and says, no, you done it. But Yosef owed Yiftach by Yishlach Malachim HaMelech B'nei Amor. Yiftach responds, and the messenger says, in the name of Yiftach, Lo lokach Yisrael et Eretz Moab, where Eretz Bnei Amon. Your version of history is that we took it, meaning without permission. It's not true. Ki balotam in Mitzrayim, because we came up from Egypt. Vayelech Yisrael bamidbar ad Yam Suf, Yavo Kadesha. We crossed the Red Sea, we came to Kadesh. Vayishlach Yisrael malachim, o melech Edom leimot. And if you remember the story, and he's quoting the history from the book of Bamidbar, we sent messengers to the king of Edom at the time to say, Ebron or Barzech, we just want to pass through. We don't want to take your land, we want to go to Israel. Velo shama melech Edom, and the history records that Edom did not listen. Vegam el melech Moab shalach velo avar, the same message to the king of Moab, he also didn't listen. But Yeshev Yisrael beKadesh, we were stuck in Kadesh. So if we wanted to get to Eretz Yisrael, we had to fight our way through the enemy. So you're telling me we took the land and we stole it, it's not really true. And of course, this is so interesting. I saw there's a Shabbaton here, you've got somebody, I don't know if any of you are attending, with a gentleman called Mitchell Bard. Mitchell Bard is a very interesting guy who's written a book, Facts About Israel. And It's a book which he actually gives away free. I don't think he actually sells it. And it's a really important book to get hold of or to read. This book of Facts About Israel goes through so much of the history of the, let's put it very bluntly, the different versions of history which are put out by all the propagandists against Israel, showing that all of their claims, right, or many of their claims, are just totally without foundation. And it goes back to this. It's the same story, ancient story, that we're really dealing with in the modern world. Israel is being accused of taking things by force, occupying territory, right? Nobody in the world now refers to Yehuda and Shomron in any other way except, like the BBC does and CNN, occupied territory. Now, what do you mean occupied territory? 1967, Right? I remember it like yesterday because it was so frightening. The announcement went out from all the Arab countries surrounding Israel, they're going to destroy the state of Israel. So what did Israel do? It defended itself. All right? And they took the initiative and they conquered that land. Now you're telling me this is occupied territory. Israel didn't want to occupy anything. Israel wanted to survive. All right? The fact that they had to move into the West Bank or now all those areas and Sinai and everything else was to self-preservation. This wasn't about sort of aggression. This was about keeping the enemy away, as far away as possible. So, you know, there's a lot of parallels over here. The fact is that the Jewish people have always been accused of taking the land of Israel by force, taking it, accused of stealing it, put it very bluntly. And those accusations in the ancient world were made, and unfortunately they get repeated in the modern world. Yeah, Ginny.
I just don't understand, this is, I'm touching on an extremely difficult and complex argument and whatever, but I don't understand how they could use the argument even here and now that we took it from them unwillfully. If we fought for it, we won it, and so there are so many examples in the world of people conquering land. Even
excellent
in
question.
I don't understand.
And there's no answer. They can't. They, as far as they're concerned, anything that the Jew does in the world, right, particularly around Israel, is always going to be wrong. And that, unfortunately, is the bottom line. And you're right. In military terms, you know, America's expanded out to different places. Certainly had wars with Mexico and wars with all these different places. If you conquer a certain part of the territory against whom you're fighting, it becomes annexed to your country. It's the way it works. The Germans did it in World War II. They annexed all of Europe. And the fact is that, you know, this is part of what war is about. And Israel has even given back so much. This is the most frustrating thing. They made a terrible mistake in 2005, giving back Gaza. It was a terrible, terrible error, which really in the history of the state of Israel is going to go down as one of the blackest decisions they ever made. Because what happened was that you just brought the enemy so much closer that they can now shoot rockets into Ashkelon. Beforehand, they couldn't get nearby, and now they can get much closer. And giving them that foothold, we got nothing back in return, right? And that in itself is so the opposite of what the world is claiming, that we gave back, right? Not only did we conquer, but we actually were prepared to give it back, and gave them an opportunity to become self-supporting. Mr. Clinton sent them a check for $15 million through some sort of foundation that he's involved with to develop the agriculture. That money is now ended up in a Swiss bank account. It's disappeared. All those beautiful places that they had in Gush Katif to grow flowers and tomatoes and everything, that was all destroyed within a week. They smashed into smithereens. And that's the sort of people you're dealing with. You're not dealing with people who want to help themselves. Right? The whole society, the whole mentality in that society is completely different. And it's tragic. Their leaders let them down. The people, the average guy in the street is suffering terribly because of poor leadership. Right? Arafat was known as being very corrupt. Now you've got Hamas, who are just a bunch of thugs, really. That's not
how they look at it.
And of course, not how they look at it, but you know, when you actually would pin them down and say, what do you really believe about this leadership? I hope someone will be honest enough to say, you know, we haven't been blessed with the greatest leader. Let's put it that way. And of course, interpretations of history, it becomes political in the propaganda exercise. And I once went to a meeting. I was in Israel, and Moshe Aharon's at the time one of the ministers of the government. I asked him, put up my hand, asked the question. I said, why is Israel still really so behind on public relations, getting the message out about, like, your question, which is a great question, and tell the world, scream it? And he said, we haven't perfected this yet. We haven't got it right. Sorry? Yeah, and with all the facilities that the Arab world has, the money and everything else that they can command, they seem to be much more successful in getting the message out there. And not only do people who watch CNN believe it, but even Jews who watch CNN believe it. And that's why still in America, over 70% of Americans have not been to Israel, because they think that bombs are dropping all the time. You ask the average American Jew living in, even in New York, in certain neighborhoods, and they'll tell you they won't go to Israel. They'd rather go to Florida, because
it's also the most, like, Muslim community is the biggest, and Islam is the biggest religion throughout the world.
Right.
So they're getting a message across, obviously, much more.
And they're doing it in the mosques, in their speeches. I mean, we know what's going on. It's very, very difficult. So there is a constant battle. And, you know, you guys are in a very fortunate position. You're in a campus where you don't have to stand up for Israel. But, you know, if you were up in Columbia or in Berkeley or anywhere, you know, around the country, that is a constant fight. And it is a fight. It becomes really physical. In London, I don't even want to talk about what's going on over there because it's just so disturbing and distressing. All right? Students are being literally, physically, you know, hustled by the Arab population on campus or the Arab support on campus. There's a lot to say about this, but it's so interesting that even though obviously the circumstances are different, the parallel in the text is fascinating. Yeah?
Which prime minister?
Sorry, which?
Prime minister.
In?
When the Gaza was given
back. Which prime minister in Israel was Mr. Sharon? And of course, after that, he became very sick and now he's in a coma for the last 6 years. Unbelievable. It's almost so scary, you know, you say that, you know, without even sort of thinking about sort of the hand of God here, it just is so frightening. And that was it. He made that decision. We don't know, did he regret the decision, not regret the decision, we just do not know. And in the end of the day, it's been a terrible decision. And the people, not only the ones who left there, but everything about it, and the consequences of it, you know, we're not in Gaza anymore. Leave us alone. So you want to shoot rockets into Israel, now you've got to shoot at us in not just Sderot, but now they're shooting to Ashkelon, they're shooting to Be'er Sheva, they're shooting... Leave us alone. Enough. In the last 2 weeks, they've shot off, I don't know how many thousands of rockets. It's beyond belief. And the world is just, you know, as far as they're concerned in this country, nobody knows about it. I mean, it was a miracle that the story with the people in France, that terrible story this week, was given as much coverage as they actually received in America. I was surprised. Because here, they're more interested in the baseball and the... you know, where this Manning guy is going to, whatever. You know, is he going to go to this team or to that team? That's much more concern the average man in the street. It's kind of sad. Anyway, I just got that off my chest. I feel much better now. I've unloaded that. Great. Let's go back to the text. It's a fascinating thing that in the ancient world, not much... here, another French phrase. Plus ça change. Plus ça change. Nothing has changed. Listen to this. Yudche. Vayelech bamidbar. Vayosav et eretz edom. Vet Eretz Moab, Vayavom Mizrach Shemesh, Eretz Moab, Vayachalom Ve'eve Arnon, Vlobo B'Gvul Moab, Ki Arnon G'Vul Moab. So basically, what's going on here is again describing the history. The Jewish people went round the area which they were not allowed to go through, and they were prepared to go around the borders and not to disturb Edom at the time. Yutep, Vayishlach Yisro Malachim, Asichom Melech Emori. Now they had a problem, they had to go through the land of the Amorites, and they sent a message to Sichon. This is all the history, right? El Sichon Melech Amori Melech Heshbon, Vayomer Lo Yisrael, Na Brano Ba'atzachad Mekomim, we want to pass by. We don't want to occupy your territory, we don't want to fight you, we just want to go, we want to get through. Give us a pass for a day or two, we'll walk through, we'll pay you for everything that we eat, right? They said, if you give us food, we'll pay you. And leave us alone. You know, we just want to. We need to go through. He's giving them a fantastic history lesson. Yiftach is not ashamed to stand up and tell the history the way it is. And he said that Sichon at the time didn't believe the Jewish people, didn't allow them Avo Bigvulo to go through his boundary. Not only that, but he started the war. So you now want me to give back the land that you started the war against me? You attacked me and now I had to defend myself. We conquered that land in self-defense. And now you're telling me I stole it? And you're telling me I have to give it back to you? Wow, the overtones, the historical overtones are amazing. As I said, Yiftach today, standing up and doing this in the United Nations will be wonderful, but nobody will be in the room. By the time he's finished, almost everybody, the American ambassador will still be there, but not many others. He's very extreme, but he's saying it the way it is. Chavala. Vayitein Hashem, and again, his emunah is coming out here. He says, in the end of the day, the only reason why we survived these battles, we were a bunch of refugees, we were going through the desert. What sort of army did we have? It's only because God helped us. Vayitein Hashem, okay, Yisrael, Tzichom et kol amo, biyad Yisrael, biyakum. God gave over the nation of Sichon, and the Jews won the battle. By Yerush Yisrael at Kol Eretz Emori Yoshev Eretz Ayin, and they inherited. They took over that land only with the help of Hashem. Chaf Git, he doesn't stop. because he's on a sort of soapbox here. Vayirshet kol gavule morid. They took over the Amorites. Me'arnon ad Yabok min Amidbar de Yarden, from those directions up to the river Jordan. All of that land, which is nowadays Jordan proper, in those days was taken over by Am Yisrael in self-defense. Now, Be'ata Chaf Gimel, Hashem Elokei Yisrael horishet ha'amorim ne'amo Yisrael. The Amorites were pushed out as well. Ve'ata Tirashenu, and you want to take it back? In other words, you are telling me you want this land because you said we stole it? You attacked us. You tried not to let us go through. We tried to make a deal with you. You rejected it. And only with the help of God did we manage to do what we did. And now you're claiming that we stole your land? Question mark. Big question mark. And he says, Chav Dalet, hello. He says, is it not? And now he's getting kind of cynical. And this is where the speech kind of gets into high gear. Keep what your God, Kamosh. That's the name of the idol. The idol is called Kamosh. The idol Kamosh, whatever Kamosh is given to you, keep it. Atoti Rosh, inherit it. And whatever our God has given us, that we will inherit. In other words, if you really want to take this land, want us to give it back, let's make a split. You keep whatever your God gives you, and we'll keep whatever our God gave us. And of course, this is saying, you know, because their God didn't give them anything, because they lost all that land. So they didn't actually get anything from their God at all. So it's kind of a cynical, almost sarcastic way of expressing this. And Kavei ve'ata tov tov atam et Balak ben Zippor melech Moab. Are you any better than the story of Balak, the famous story of Balak and Bilam, Harov Rav in Israel, who made a fight with Israel in the Chom Nechambam? Did we have a fight with him? In other words, remember Balak invited Bilam to curse the Jewish people, and that was the way that he tried to deal with us. And again, are you any better than that? B'shevet Yisrael kavah b'cheshbon b'vnotah b'areh b'vnotah. We were in those places on the way to Israel in Cheshbon and Aror, b'chol ha'arim asher yedei Arnon, in the land of Arnon, shalosh me'ot shana. In the end of the day, we kept our presence in that land for 300 years till today. In other words, if you are so concerned about the land which we took when we came out of Egypt, it's now 300 years later. Where have you been for the last 300 years? All right, it's a question that, you know, you can ask in today's world, that you're so concerned, you want Israel to give back all this land over and over again. You know, 40 years ago, nearly 50 years ago, there was a war. You lost the war. So where have you been for the last 50 years? All of a sudden, you know, with politics and the way that you manipulate the whole system, you can now come and make those claims. Okay? It's when it suits you. And Yiftach is saying, if this is, you're doing it because it suits you, then it doesn't suit us. And the 300 years, I'm not going to go through it. Rashi makes a fantastic calculation about the 300 years, exactly how that number is justified with all the various judges, etc., that have come about. And we're in with Yiftach, we're in around 300 years into the period of judges. So if you think period of judges is another 69 years, we're about two-thirds, even three-quarters of the way through the period of judges. So we haven't got much more to go. Okay, so again, just to mention that point I mentioned at the beginning, the majority of time in the period of the judges was not time which was bad. It was time when the people really did live in kind of a harmony, and they did observe. But there were periods, obviously, where it wasn't quite like that. Now, Kav Zayin, we want to get to the end of this. It's a great story. So Yiftach is going to rub it in their noses one more time. He says, I did not sin against you. You're doing bad against me. You want to fight me? You Ammonites want to come against me? Let the God, meaning Hashem, our God, judge between you and me. All right, that's the challenge. Basically, if this is the way you want to play it, then let's see how the God of Israel decides the story. And of course, there was no response. You got to a point where you almost made peace, right? Go back to the year 2000. There was almost a point where there was a negotiation with Clinton was still in the White House. Arafat was there. Barak was there. They almost agreed to give away 97% of the so-called occupied territory of Israel the West Bank, 90, including half of Jerusalem and Arafat, for some reason which we don't know. Many people say this again was Yad Hashem. Arafat said no. He doesn't want 97% of that, he wants 100%. And he wasn't prepared to give in. So he showed exactly, this evil man is now somewhere in Gehinnom somewhere, he is showing exactly what his real agenda was. It wasn't to make peace, it was really to conquer and destroy the state of Israel. And that was what he was about. And that is, again, I hear the echoes, it's so interesting. And Yiftach is saying, in the end of the day, if you claim that we stole your land, then let God decide between you and me. And that's the bottom line. And look at Kafcheh, below Shema Melech B'nei Amon. Surprise. Al-Dibre Yiftach She'eshalach Elav. The king of Ammon basically did not listen to a word that Yiftach had said. He didn't want to know. Because he's basically, you know, he's not interested in the discussion. He just wants, give the land back, and then we can go and conquer you and, you know, and basically destroy you. And that's the agenda, and it hasn't changed. Kaftet, at this point we get this very famous war. But to he, al-Yiftach, Ruach Hashem, there was a spirit of God. The Targum says, Ruach Gevurah, a spirit of strength. The Malbim, I think, says over here, Ruach Nevuah, even a spirit of prophecy. And that's very interesting, because Yiftach is not, as they said, famous as being one of the holiest judges, but even at the time when he stands up for the sake of Am Yisrael, he gets a Ruach Hashem, a spirit of God. I really feel that happens even to the secular leaders of Israel. When David Ben-Gurion announced the state of Israel that Friday afternoon, it's a famous thing, you can look at it on YouTube, and see what he did, how he announced it, and how on Friday afternoon, literally about half an hour before Shabbat, they stood up and they said Shechianu, and then they went home and they knew that by the next day there'd be a war. And yet, he stood up and made that announcement and the Declaration of Independence of Medinat Yisrael. It's one of the most moving things, really, you'll ever watch. Because you realize that it took Ruach Hashem, it really took a spirit of God, there's something to do it. Ben-Gurion, until the last minute, wasn't sure if he could announce it. Because of the war implications, everyone was saying, as soon as you announce the state of Israel, that's it. They're going to invade, you're finished. And he still stood up there and did it. And they said Shechianu. It's a very moving thing to watch. And of course the rest of it is history. But very fascinating and something that we should be aware of. So Chavte, Batiya Yiftach Ruach Hashem V'Yavod Gilad V'et Menashe. At this point, Yiftach tries to gather people from Gilad and from Menashe to fight. V'Yavod Mitzvei Gilad, Mitzvei Gilad Avar B'nei Amon. And he confronts the Ammonites. Got his army. And he now does something which is really difficult. Laman. Vayidar Yiftach Neder Lashem Vayomar. He makes a vow. Famous story. Im Noton Titein Et B'nei Amon Biyadim. O Lord, if you give these people, the enemy, into my hand, Vahaya Yotzei Asher Yotzei Midaltei Beiti Likrati. Whatever comes out of my house, the first thing that comes out, B'shuvi B'shalom Ibnei Amon, when I come back in peace, when we won the war, Haya Lashem Valitiu Ola, will be to God, I will make a Ola, I will make it into a burnt offering. Now of course he was expecting what would come out of his house, a sheep, maybe a cow, right? The rabbis say, but why did he make this vow when maybe it could have been a dog, could have been a cat, alright? So the fact is, of course, what was it in the end? We all know. What happened in the end? Who came out of his house? His daughter, which makes it even worse. But, you know, this whole vow is very, very straight. We're going to have to deal with it. We'll come back to this.
I did my paper on this, so yeah. I know a lot of the commentaries, but also a lot of rabbis said that he was never even expecting an animal to come out of his house because no one keeps animals in their house.
Yeah, well, in those days, not so much. It's possible. Because remember, when they went out of Egypt, they tied the korban, it says, to the bed. Okay, they had these lambs which they kept in their homes. But obviously the suggestion is that that was out of the ordinary. So normally they wouldn't keep them in their homes.
Right.
Right?
So it's kind of outside or attached outside.
Attached outside. So that would be the normal thing.
But I think
you can see this as more altruistic. What he's basically saying is that I'm not really expecting anything to come out to put this into practice. I want to do something which is, or say something which is an act of holiness. And I want to go to the war in a spirit of holiness. Right? I think that's what he's trying to do. The problem is that because of his lack of knowledge of this setup, how to actually go about this, he's created a commitment, at least in his own mind. Now, what happens in the law of vows is something we're going to talk about. Vows can be made, vows can be broken. All right, but not broken in the sense of not observing them, but actually annul the vow. That means that you say the whole thing never really should have been made in the first place. And this is something that should have happened. This is the big question. If this is a vow, a commitment, which should never have been made and can actually be annulled, then why didn't somebody stand up and do it? Why didn't somebody stand up and say, Yifta, with all due respect, you made a big mistake over here. This promise that you made should never have been made. In which case, the whole promise should be, as it were, batel and batel. It's completely done away with. And that's the serious question over here, and we're going to have to deal with that. Yeah.
I don't understand. Like, it says that if I win the war, something will come out of my...
Well, anything that comes out will be, the first thing I will do when I come back is make a sacrifice. He's basically saying, as a thank you to Hashem, relying on the fact that he hopes and prays that God will help him, as a kind of almost saying, you know, I'm ready to do something when I come home from war. The first thing I do is not go and drink a pint of beer. And I'm not going to go and watch the baseball game. I'm going to go and take a sacrifice to Hashem.
Okay, so what's wrong about that?
The answer is because he's made this commitment very generic, klali. And the trouble with a klali thing like this is that who's going to come out of the house? All right. If somebody comes out which is not fit to be sacrificed, he's got a problem. Because he said, I've got to make a korban, and he's not necessarily going to be able to do it. So that becomes what is called a neda levatala. The Torah is very, very, what's the word? Very careful about the darim.
Why did he
not to say these words? That's something which was, again, as I said, an act of kedusha, something which he felt was a holy thing to do. But it's sometimes you do these holy things out of ignorance. All right, so there are people, many Jewish people who, I don't know, even I would argue, when they make they keep various chagim, but they don't keep them the way according to halacha. But people now start buying food for Pesach, but they don't necessarily get rid of the chametz. It's a well intentioned, but it's not really doing the right thing. All right, it's not doing the correct thing. Let's put it that way. The right thing maybe because they're still keeping the tradition, but are they doing it the way it should be done? The answer is no. And it's always this kind of, I meant to do well, but did I really do what I was supposed to do? No. And this is what Yiftach seems to be doing. He's making a commitment, but should it really have been made? The answer is no. Yeah.
The house comment, isn't it that houses in that time had an inner courtyard, and that's what he was referring to?
Yeah, it could be. I don't know if it was that sophisticated. This would be something you have to go off to the, whichever museum it is, somewhere around here, to see exactly, according to the time frame, what sort of houses they actually lived in. They did eventually have houses with inner courtyards. They'd have a well in the courtyard for the water, they'd have animals hanging out there, chickens or whatever, and then the houses would be built like four dwellings around the courtyard, usually. And that's the way it was established. But at this point in time, I'm not sure. It's a good point, Anna. Again, you'd have to do a bit of research. You could find that out. It'd be something worth sort of investigating. Yes, question?
Yeah, I just wanted to say also, you said that the reason that you think he made the oath was a reason of, he wanted to be, it's a reason of holiness.
Seemingly, I'm suggesting it, yeah.
Right, so in my paper I suggested, my suggestion or the way that I read it and interpreted it was, I know you're very, you give the benefit of the doubt.
I try to.
And you try to,
I try
find
to.
The good in a lot of people, so I think that's wonderful.
Good. Thank you, Sarah.
Very quickly, I interpreted this oath as just like every other story. I told you after class once that just like every other story that this might have stemmed from a feat of doubt that he had in God, that he said to God, if you don't, If you help me win this war, I'll give you a sacrifice. As
a
backup plan to...
Yeah, sort of insurance policy.
Like an insurance policy.
I hear you. And it's possible. I hear you. And I don't disagree with what you've said. All right? Because I looked at it from one perspective. I've got to toe the party line. I have to, because I'm trying to give... I'm more concerned about the overall reputation of Yiftach, which I know, generally speaking, certainly when I went through yeshiva and we always spoke about Yiftach, if we ever did, it was always very much on a negative line as opposed to being positive. And then I read this piece from Rav Soloveitcher and it really changed my whole view. Right? That, you know, he's a link in the chain. He's a shofet. He's a man of God. He does make a terrible error here, and the question is not only about his behavior during this whole business, but Pinchas as well. And that becomes really challenging. Because Pinchas is someone that we really have a very fixed idea about what he should be doing, and he doesn't do it. And that's a big question. We'll come to that. Yeah.
It's also very easy to make a nether that seems very broad and not realize at the time that it isn't broad. Like,
and that's the whole thing. We're supposed not to do that.
Right.
Yeah, we're supposed to be careful. Correct. It's an easy mistake to make. But as a leader, he's got to be so careful. I mean, I can understand why. It's an act of zeal. It's an act of rallying the troops. You know, by the sake of God, when we come back.
Well, he even said he was a leader for war. He wasn't spiritual.
Well, that's it. He becomes more spiritual once he's accepted.
Right, that doesn't mean he was like a high...
Not a God ladder. Like, correct. There is, I mean, the rabbis are very direct about this, that he was an Amah Aretz. They say it very, very directly that he was an ignoramus when it came to certain aspects. It doesn't say everything, but certain aspects of Jewish law, which we would have expected him to be knowledgeable about.
Right, so then wouldn't that kind of make up sense for saying something like that?
Yeah.
Then how come he's saying something like that?
Yeah, but the answer is that nevertheless, you should never have said it. We can give you all the benefits of the doubt, but once you've created... That's like creating the monster. Once you created the monster, what do you do with the monster? I can't just switch it off. It's not like the golem, right? The famous story of the Maharal. You pull out the Shem Hashem and the thing sort of goes back to dust. In this case, you created a circumstance which you've got to deal with.
But then what would have happened if he didn't?
Yeah, and that's, again, going to be a big question.
If his daughter went and prayed for like...
There is a big discussion what exactly happens in the end, which, again, we're going to talk about next time. Alright, so I don't want to deal with that now, but I'm just going to show you the psukim for today, and Mr. Shem next week will do a bit more analysis, because it's very, very disturbing, this story. Very disturbing. Just going to finish it off. We've got a few minutes. So, Lamed Bet. The war is kind of almost immaterial. It happened, and, you know, as they say in the Ivrit Chik Chak, everything was over. The enemy was given over by God. They were smitten, the enemy was killed from Aroer, from this place, until another place called Minit. Esrim Ir, 20 cities that they controlled were all taken over. Ad Avel Kramim, to the place called Avel Kramim. Makah Gedola Ma'od, a tremendous defeat for the enemy. Vayikano B'nei Amom, Ibnei B'nei Yisrael, and the enemy was humble. They were defeated, they were destroyed. Vayavo Yiftach HaMitzvah El Beito, now of course Yiftach comes home as a hero. And then, bam, he remembers his promise. His daughter was so thrilled to see her father, she runs out of the house to greet him. What a tragedy. And even worse, she's playing music. She's playing drums or whatever she's doing. She's dancing. And Simcha, she was so happy that he had won. In other words, she's his only daughter, no other children. What a terrible story. He saw her, he felt that his promise could not be broken. And he did kriya. It was like already he was in mourning. Kriya is something that you do. You tear your coat when you begin the period known as Shiva, the period of mourning. And this is already mourning for his daughter, because he knows that his promise was to make a sacrifice. Did not occur to him that, number one, human sacrifice is absolutely forbidden. You know, I mean, this is the question again. Did he not know the story of Yitzchak, the Akedah? Did he not know what had happened in Jewish history? It boggles the mind over here. But look what he says. Vayoramen, he says, Ahabiti, woe my daughter, hachrai chratani, bata yit vachrai. I'll read the English translation. You made me fall. You become one of those that trouble me. Anochi patziti pi al Hashem v'lo chalashuv. I've opened my mouth to God. I can't go back. He basically says that you are now going to cause me terrible grief. I'm going to have to do something about it. But it doesn't say what he does. And this is the big question. There's a big machloket in the Meforshim, the Ramban, I think, and Ibn Ezra. They argue about what happens next. It's like one of those TV shows. When they stop the camera, what happens next? And we're not quite sure. Look at the psukim, lamadva, batomer elah. So she says to him, Avi, patsitat picha l'Hashem. You open your mouth to God. Asei li kashe yetzah mipicha. Do what you promised to do. She didn't know what he promised to do. Acharei ashe asah lecha Hashem lekamon me'evecha b'nei amon. God has given you a tremendous victory. Keep your promise to God. What's the problem? Vatomer l'Aviyah. Again, interesting. Posek lamadvav, she's speaking. Posek lamadzayin, it says again, Vatoma, she speaks. What about her father? What happened in the meantime? What was coming out of her father's mouth? Ephes. Nothing. Right? There's like a pause here. She said to her father, Abba, she said, what's the problem? You promised to God, you want to do something in praise of Hashem, do it. Silence. Abba says nothing. Lamed Zayin. Vatoma l'Aviyah. Because she sees his face. She sees how desperately unhappy he is. She can't understand. Then the penny drops. She understands. Oh, Father, at least, because she now realizes what it was all about. Maybe somebody whispered in her ear, don't you remember what your father promised to do to make a sacrifice? You just came out of the house. You're the one. So she says to her father, Abba, leave me alone. Harpe mi meni, leave me alone for 2 months. I will go down upon the mountains. The rabbis say, Harim here is a euphemism. It actually means the mountains representing the Sanhedrin. Because to go down the mountain is strange. Normally you go up a mountain. All right. If you're going skiing, presumably before you go down the mountain, you've got to go up the mountain. That's what I assume. And in this case, she says, I'm going down on the mountain. So that suggests, says the rabbis, that it doesn't mean literally, but she's going to try and find a way out. She's going to try and petition the rabbis to break the vow. Please listen, to change the circumstance. And I will mourn over my virginity. She's basically saying that for 2 months we will try our best. Myself, I have friends, we'll try and do something about this. But Yoman, he says, finally he gets up the ability to speak. Lechi go. Not with any sort of blessing or anything else. Vayishlach otah shnei chadashim. He sent her away for 2 months. Vatedichi v'reoteh v'tevcha b'tuleh l'arim. And she and her friends went and cried. Because she wasn't married yet. She knew at this point in time that she really was not ever going to marry. And on top of that, to go to the harim means that she also cried on the shoulders or before the rabbis. Please. Moriva Rabotai, find a way out of it. This can't be right. This can't be fair. The fact is that what's going to happen to me? Either I'm going to have to live my whole life in isolation, never to get married, or the worst case scenario, the Ramban says, that Yiftah will keep his promise and he'll kill her. And he will actually make her into a human sacrifice. And that's the scariest thing. And the Ramban is insistent, exactly what Yiftah did. There's no proof in the Pesukim. All it says is the following, Lamed Tet, we're nearly finished. The end of 2 months, she came back to her father. So all it says, he fulfilled the vow. It doesn't say, did he kill her? Did he not kill her? It doesn't say. It just says he fulfilled his promise. She never knew a man, meaning she never got married. Yisrael became a statue in Israel. In other words, everybody knew about her. Either that she was killed by her father and she never married, she was single, or that she lived a secluded life, which was as if she was dead. She was never going to mix again in society because her father said she's got to be like a korban. Korban means set aside, completely set aside from regular use. And mem miyomim yomima, and from year to year, teilachna benot Yisrael, the tanot lebat Yiftach giladi, the daughters of Israel go to the daughter of Yiftach to lament. Now, does it mean that she was there and she received them and they cried together? Or do they just go to her graveside and make some sort of memorial for her? It's not clear. Abat yamim bashana, for 4 days in the year. What a crazy story. Yiftach has this fantastic sense of history. He has this fantastic sense of leadership. He rallies the people at the right time. And then when it comes to it, he makes this religious, I suppose you would call it, decoration. I don't know how you're going to describe it. An act of religiosity, which is really, really, you can argue it had a certain place. It made sense. He wants to do something for Shem Hashem. But there is a way of going about it. And because of his lack of knowledge, it didn't work out the way it should have been. I don't know. I'm really out to lunch about this story in many ways. The end of the story, did he carry out his vow? Did he actually kill her? Or what happened to her? That's a question we'll deal with next week. Also, where were the other rabbis? Where was the Sanhedrin? When she goes and cries, Al-Herim, as it says, what did they say to her? Why didn't they help her? And the biggest question, which is that she is literally caught between her father's insistence on one side to uphold the vow, and the Godlador Pinchas on the other side, who doesn't seem to be doing anything. And why doesn't Pinchas get involved to the point where he saves her, or at least he'll come to her? Let him come and speak to Yiftach, or let Yiftach go and speak to him. Alright, Pinchas is much older. So let Yiftach get on his donkey and go out, go and see Pinchas. Let them work it out. There doesn't seem to be any sense of connection. And that is very disturbing. That's very distressing. So on the one hand, we start Yiftach on a high, and we end with a tremendous sense of disappointment, almost, I would say, not just sadness, but tragedy. You feel the tragedy here. And the question, of course, is why? Big, big question, which we're going to deal with as Rav Hashem on Tuesday. I want you also, please, read ahead chapter 12. Significant. Just tell you very quickly what happened. The tribe of Ephraim did not get involved in the war, and they were very upset with Yiftach. And as a result, Yiftach has not only had a war with Ammon, but he now has a fight with the tribe of Ephraim. 42,000 of Ephraim get killed. Unbelievable. So this whole story, which started off maybe in such a high, now descends yet again, like Abimelech, into a civil war situation. And that becomes significant. Read that chapter, it's not a long one. Chapter 12. And with that knowledge, we may be able to also answer some of the questions about Yiftach, Bezrat Hashem, on Tuesday. Wish everybody Shabbat Shalom. Thank you.
Thank you.